Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Live from the Toby Family Auditorium at the Commonwealth Club, it's Week to Week, the Political Roundtable for Monday, November 27th, 2017. Welcome, everyone. Now, often I will begin one of these programs by reading a tweet from the president. He writes a lot of them. Kind of writes so many of them, I figure sooner or later they'll be like combined into a little red book we'll all have to memorize. But tonight, I wanted to share a tweet written by one of our panelists. Doug Sovereign recently wrote, quote, "Priceless moments in parenting. One of my kids saw me on TV, BBC, and shouted out, quote, Daddy Fake News, unquote, as if that were my name. Savvy kid, unquote." So fake or real, we're glad you're all here tonight.
It's true.
I mean, at least they noticed you were on TV.
Like, Daddy Fake News, Daddy Fake News. I was like,
Wow.
I did dress as fake news for Halloween, so that's what put it in his mind, I think.
Very good. Well, I'm John Zipper, your host for Week to Week and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. And on today's program, we are going to discuss the latest harassment claims that are still roiling the political establishment, speculation that the former National Security Advisor is cooperating with Robert Mueller's investigation, the Congressional Tax Bill, Janet Napolitano in the UC, the President's Twitter feud with a father, and other political news, and of course, we'll end the evening with our live news quiz. As always, I note that the Commonwealth Club features folks with a wide range of views, so any opinions expressed up here are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. So let's meet our panelists for tonight. I'm going to start on the far end of the stage with Dan Schnur. He's the director for the Los Angeles region of the American Jewish Committee. He's the former chairman of California's Fair Political Practices Commission, and he's on Twitter at Dan Schnur. So welcome, Dan. Next to him is Marisa Lagos, excuse me. She's a reporter for California Politics and Government at KQED. She's on Twitter at mlagos. So welcome back. Next to me is Doug Sovereign, a.k.a. Daddy Fake News. He's a reporter for KCBS, and he's on Twitter at Sovereign Nation. So thank you.
I think I need to get a mug that says Daddy Fake News.
Yes, best Daddy Fake News of all. Please use the question cards that are spread throughout the room. Write down some questions. They'll be brought up to me, and I will ask as many as I can during the hour today. So on to our roundtable. Now, just earlier today, California Democratic Assemblyman Raul Bocanegra of Los Angeles resigned in the face of allegations of sexual misconduct. He originally was going to resign effective
next September,
yeah. Right? Today he made it effective immediately. Now, there are new allegations of sexual misconduct pretty much on a daily basis these days. I mean, no need to even draw, Democrats Al Franken, John Conyers, Raul Bocanegra, Tony Mendoza, Republicans George Herbert Walker Bush, Roy Moore, Donald Trump, Wesley Goodman, Don Shooter, and others are all reacting to allegations of sexual misconduct. So this is a political roundtable, so we're not even going to get into the Charlie Roses and the Kevin Spaceys, et cetera, and et cetera, you know, people who are in other industries. But let's start with what we know actually today. So Marisa, tell us about what we know about Raul Bocanegra's resignation. What situation was he facing?
Right. So like many of the men who have been accused of sexual harassment, he had this amazing statement where he did not take responsibility. He blamed the political... Wait.
It was a hurricane of political opportunism.
Thank you. He's been doing radio longer than me. That smooth voice.
Hurricane of political opportunity. He's
which
caught in
unclear
it.
Who like whose opportunism.
That's probably due to climate change, though. Right?
Yes, the hurricane of- I mean maybe all six Republicans are making a comeback in Sacramento. I don't like. It's crazy because if you know the history of this guy, the first accusations against him, which were essentially upheld by the legislature, were when he was a staff member to a former assemblyman. He was ordered to stay away from this woman whom he had groped in a bar at a work event. And then he ran for office, and when he got there, the assembly said, well, the settlement telling you to stay away from her no longer applies because you're an assemblyman. So everybody knew about this. So I'm a little unclear about the political opportunism. But this comes on the eve. You know, tomorrow the assembly is holding their first hearing on this matter. And so I think it's very likely from what I'm hearing that there are going to be more allegations and more names told in the coming weeks and days.
Dan, let's go down to you. I mean, what we've been seeing, I mean, okay, so the Democratic-dominated California legislature is about as bad at handling these issues as the Republican-dominated Congress in Washington. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are lots of folks who are complaining that this stuff is, you know, hushed up. People are paid off. You know, it's the system is set up to protect the accused and not the accusers. Is there anything that's going to change this? I don't mean to sound that as like, you know, the naive, oh, why can't this be fixed? But I mean, are there any forces in Sacramento, for example, who are doing anything or can do anything?
This one feels different. And I teach both at the University of Southern California at UC Berkeley. And as it happens, my class at USC this semester is made up predominantly of young women. And so after the Harvey Weinstein matter broke in the news, we talked about it in class. And what struck me more than anything else is how discouraged these young women were, 19, 20, 21 years old. Said, nothing's going to change. We've seen this before. It's just going to go away, and then it'll be back to normal. Last Tuesday in class, we talked about it again. Because, of course, in the month or so since Weinstein, as you mentioned, Charlie Rose, Kevin Spacey, all the political figures we've been talking about, I asked them the question again. And I'll defer to a 19 or 20-year-old young woman on this because this is her life and her future in a way that I can't hope to understand. And they felt differently. They felt in a way that they didn't 1 month ago, that there was a real prospect for change, that given the sheer numbers of those coming forward, given the technology which provided a platform that didn't exist in the days of Anita Hill, they were much, much more encouraged than they'd been even 4, 5, 6 weeks ago. Now, toward Maurice's point, I will say I'm relieved that that there are 120 members of the California State Legislature, of whom approximately 100 are men. And so I'm just relieved that the two who've been involved in this kind of horrendous activity have now been found out, and now we're done with this, and we can move on, because, of course...
But that's the point, right? Yeah. It's like the structural issue.
Exactly right. And I would say that if there was ever to put this in a political context, and then I hope we can go back to the broader societal and cultural matter context because it's a more important one. But from a sheer political standpoint, I remember, as do many of you, that 1992 was the year of the woman in the aftermath of the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill hearings. I will suggest to you that 2018 will make 1992 look like an old boys club by comparison, and with the possible and puzzling exception of the California governor's race, I suspect you will see an influx of female candidates and challengers of both parties at all levels of government, the likes of which we have never seen before in American politics. And while it is horrific, it is horrendous, it's unforgivable that we have to go through this kind of societal trauma in order to get there, if there is a silver lining that comes out of all this horror, it is that finally and belatedly we will begin to take overdue and necessary steps toward gender balance in the ranks of our elected officials. And I think what's been agreed upon, whether in Hollywood, whether in Washington, whether in the restaurant industry or in high tech, is that when women rise to positions of power in significant numbers, that's when you begin to see these problems being addressed in a satisfactory way. And I think 2018 will be remembered for many, many years as the year that landmark progress was made on this front.
Well, it's like, I mean, go ahead, clap for him.
Bold.
Yeah. I like his positive prediction. Yeah. I also want to say that, you know, within politics, part of the problem has been in Hollywood, I think it's a little more nebulous. It's the power and
the casting couch.
Yeah. But in politics, it's pretty clear. In U.S. Congress, if you are to accuse somebody of sexual harassment, a sitting member, you have to undergo a 30-day waiting period. You have to go undergo another 30 days of mediation. I mean, there is like, it's insane. When I read this process, I couldn't even believe that that would have been what anybody would come up with as a fair sort of structure. And the state legislature, kind of similar thing. It's the rules committee as opposed to the ethics committee, but you do have basically the fox guarding the hen house. And I will say in a lot of cases, it's included women. And I think that that has to do with Dan's point, which is that if you are, you know, 20% of any body, how much of a voice do you really get, right? Mm-hmm. If you are sort of, if your power is predicated on being accepted into a boys' club, and not to excuse, I think, some of the women who have covered up this behavior in the past, but it does sort of lend itself to that situation. And so I do think within the sphere of politics, there are like very simple structural and legislative changes that could help at least get to some of this.
And I do think, I mean, I agree with Dan that I think this is a tipping point in a way that we could not have foreseen. You know, Donald Trump apparently is not going to be Time Magazine's Person of the Year. I would say it should be Rose McGowan. I had no idea who Rose McGowan was. I still am not clear who she is other than that she's an actress. But she's the one who first accused Harvey Weinstein, which led to the floodgates opening. And look at the impact this is having. With one exception, I don't think tech is going to move as quickly as the other sectors. I think women are less likely to come forward in the tech sector for a variety of reasons. But I do think in politics and in media, this is a tipping point. And, you know, Jackie Speier, one of our Bay Area Congress members, is finally going to get this legislation through to change what Marisa's talking about, where there's this ridiculous and cumbersome process that makes it almost impossible for anything to get done. And that would never have happened without this. So I do think there's a lot of pressure being brought to bear, and there will be, we hope, lasting, but at least significant short-term change.
When this first happened in Sacramento, what, a month or so ago, I had dinner with Melanie Mason, the LA Times reporter who broke the story, who's done amazing work and has, you know, a lot of which is because of her personal relationships and the fact that these women trusted her to come forward. And we were talking about the sort of pitfalls moving forward, right? There's the, okay, one or two people gets outed and they become the sacrificial lambs, and then everybody just kind of moves forward. On the other side of that, you know, fine, we talk about these structural changes and we have these lawyers come in and do these reviews, but nobody who's actually been accused of anything, you know, gets out of it. And so far it seems like, in a good way, both of those things are happening. You know, I think that's going to, again, depend on the leadership in the state legislature, and we're going to have a new president pro tem of the Senate pretty soon, because Kevin DeLeon is running against Dianne Feinstein, so I think we'll be hearing more about these issues in that race. But I think it's very likely that whoever takes over is going to be a woman, and I think that it'll be interesting to see how that informs this process as well.
Mm-hmm. I did want to ask about that. Kevin DeLeon, of course, is running against Senator Dianne Feinstein. Is his candidacy going to survive? I mean, he's been tied to a lot of problems with this and the way the Senate has handled or mishandled sexual harassment claims.
I mean, it
certainly doesn't help that his roommate was one of the folks who has been accused.
And
Doug?
Maybe more. Well, I think it's always been an uphill fight in this case. I mean, his whole candidacy is I'll fight Trump, and Feinstein represents the old guard. And certainly, I mean, I was there. I think you were there, too, when she said she still hopes Trump can be a good president. I think you were there.
Scott was there.
Oh, Scott was there.
At the Commonwealth Club.
Yeah,
it was at the Commonwealth Club. And there was this gasp in the room, and there were boos. And Ed said, you know, I think we should give him time. He still could become a – whoa. And that's not what a lot of people in California Democratic circles want to hear. And that's really the entire platform DeLeon is running on. So there's a little bit of legs for that. But, yes, when you're a man who presided over this body that now turns out to have – some problems in handling one of the hot issues of the day, and you're running against a woman, that makes your climb a little steeper than it would have been to begin with. So if his candidacy had legs, he's sort of running in wet cement at the moment, I think.
And let's not forget she was elected in the 1992 Year of the Woman. Well, someone from the audience asks, why are sexual harassment settlements in Congress paid by public funds? Can that be stopped? I was kind of surprised when I read one of those.
Yeah.
But
yeah, same law that requires mediation between the accused and the accuser. That was a 1995 law, I believe.
Yes, and worse than mediation and worse than the use of public funds, of course, is the pressure for the individual to sign a non-disclosure agreement. Mm-hmm. And to me, the most unfortunate of many unfortunate exchanges over the last couple weeks has been Congressman Conyers making assertions that he knows that his accuser is legally prohibited from rebutting. Mm. I suspect under the leadership of Representative Speer and Representative Comstock, a bipartisan team in the House of Representatives, you'll see a dramatic overhaul of these rules going forward. Doug, I think you're right about Silicon Valley, and it's a longer conversation. I would make you this prediction, though. After Hollywood, after politics, I'd mention the restaurant industry, which is probably the most horrendous example of this kind of behavior for anyone who's ever worked or anyone, if you care about anyone who's worked in a restaurant. Wall Street is coming next, and that's going to be particularly ugly. But to the point about not just De Leon, but the male candidates for state office. This is really puzzling to me. This will, next year will be the year of the woman in American politics, as I mentioned earlier. But it's puzzling to me, if I were still running campaigns as I did a trillion years ago, I would be telling male candidates that if there was ever a time for you to show moral outrage towards, it ought to be towards something that is this morally outrageous. Mm-hmm. And De Leon, who, if all of you remember, much more than Jerry Brown, much more than Javier Becerra, much more than Anthony Rendon, much more than any other California politician, was the first one post-election 1 year ago to really go at President-elect Trump and go at him hard.
That's true.
On environmental issues, on immigration issues, on a number of others. Watching him and watching Gavin Newsom and watching Antonio Villaraigosa and watching John Chung all saying the right things, but without the kind of outrage that I would want in my leaders. And that's not me saying that I wouldn't vote for any of them. That's a conversation for another day. But it is puzzling to me that our politicians of both genders in this state are not voicing the kind of outrage that so many of us are feeling.
So I wonder how much that might help Delaine Easton, the only woman in the race for governor, who stood out a bit at the first couple debates, forums, I guess they weren't technically debates, because she was feisty and impassioned. And she
but
was
didn't
the only
bring
woman.
This up at
well,
that
this
debate.
Was before, but
no, at the one right after this all broke in Orange County.
But wasn't it just the Harvey Weinstein at that point? Had anything else happened?
John, can I say something totally unfair and subjective?
Yeah. I love it. Go for
okay.
it.
It wasn't quite the issue it is.
There was
now.
An opportunity for a female political leader to take advantage of this moment. Yeah. It's not Delaney Easton.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and someone from the audience does ask, does California have any woman who could be governor in the near future?
Well, the only one who's running is Delaney Easton, and I don't see anybody else getting in the race. Mm-hmm. So certainly in the near future, but not in this cycle.
Okay. We've actually got quite a few questions on the sexual harassment issue, as you could expect. There are a couple of them. I'm going to merge them because they're kind of similar, and that is people dealing with some changing definitions of harassment, sometimes broader, sometimes narrower, and HR departments are kind of like running to catch up to this in some cases. Do we expect any official, you know, whether it's legal or even just internal to the way the Sacramento or Washington handles their issues of sexual harassment and how they define it and show any leadership on it?
I mean, again, part of the problem here is the structure, right? There's not like an HR department and the legislature or Congress the way there is at most offices you might work at. I think there's also just a straight up cultural problem, twofold, really. One is that a lot of politics involves drinking and situations that are not sort of office friendly, where you have.
I'll drink to that.
Yeah. Sometimes with responsibility. I downed mine before we got up here. So, so you have these situations where you have people within positions of power, lawmakers and staffers at these events with lobbyists and consultants and other people. And I think that, not that drinking excuses sexual harassment, because I think we all know we can all drink
only
and not sexually harass people.
Only when it's Kevin Spacey, then it's
then it's okay. But there's that part of it. And then there's this thing I sort of alluded to before, which is I think that there has been a protection of the institution that is sort of culturally passed down from members to other members that, again, has included women doing the same thing. And so, the Assembly and the Senate in California, for example, are taking a slightly different tax. The Assembly they both sort of hired outside consultants and they're doing reviews and they want to talk about their processes. But, you know, I would argue that some of this goes well beyond any of these institutions. It's to our culture and the fact that, you know, we're talking about on the very far end of the spectrum, people who are absolute sexual predators and rapists mm-hmm. and assaulters. And then there's the guys who just, you know, use, I think, what is part of our culture to approach women in certain ways, to talk to women in certain ways. And I think that until, you know, you have to call out the people on the far end of the spectrum, but you also, and I think that this is one thing that I'm really heartened by, is that I think women are feeling more emboldened to stand up for each other in those situations that maybe aren't worth taking to HR, so to speak.
Something someone in the audience asked, which is, can we make, or how can we make those differentiations between George Herbert Walker Bush doing something he shouldn't do, but quite different from Roy Moore allegedly,
right.
you know,
there are many shades along the spectrum. But I have to say just a couple things. One, first of all, back to policies. I've been at CBS for 27 years, and I cannot tell you how many mandatory sexual harassment trainings I've had to undergo.
Did they work?
I mean, we'll discuss it later.
We should point out that you and all employees had to go to this. This is not just me, you.
But we have had to do this. Just me. It's called the sovereign. No. I mean, at least once a year, I'm sure we have to go through these modules. And everyone I know who works in any kind of corporate setting or university setting has to. And I was astounded to discover that there's no such mandatory training for Congress, for Senate or the House. And when they were proposing, I was like, wait, are you kidding? They don't have to do this? We do. Yeah. And I mean, anyone who works in an office has to undergo these trainings. And I can guarantee you, if I ever did do anything wrong, CBS would not be paying my settlements. So that one blew me away, too. But other than that, you know, when I hear every one of these cases, I think, what is this guy thinking? I mean, maybe I'm enlightened because I have a lot of sisters. I don't know. but you know, to come out of a shower naked, right? That's not the sexual predator model you're talking about. But some of these things these guys do, and I think, does he really think, oh, I thought it was
a
mutual interest. I was like, are you
power
kidding?
Play.
I mean,
yeah.
I mean, like, I'm blown away by a lot of what I hear.
It's like pathological.
It is a power play. And Harvey,
some of it is power. And a lot of it is power.
And Harvey Weinstein and Roy Moore and Bill mm-hmm. Clinton and Donald Trump and Kobe Bryant and Tiger Woods mm-hmm. all come from the same place, which mm-hmm. is I have achieved a level of success in society, which means that the rules no longer apply to me.
And Louis C.K.
And so therefore, I'm no longer going to abide by them. Marisa, I take your point and push it a step further. Politics isn't just a culture where alcohol is pervasive. And I say this, by the way, before anybody else brings it up. I should say this. I bring this up as someone who not once but twice was stopped for DUI as a young Capitol staffer in the 1990s. And I quit drinking 23 years ago because in that culture I didn't think there was room for the kind of gray area which ought to exist. But it's not just alcohol. It's a lot of alcohol in an environment where lots of people are hundreds or thousands of miles away mm-hmm. from their spouses. Mm-hmm. When they're working late nights with people whose livelihoods depend on their favor. Yeah. If you are an elected member of Congress or a state legislature, whether it's a staff member, whether it's a lobbyist, whether it's someone working for a trade association, the currency of the realm in Sacramento and Washington, and Marisa alluded to it earlier in a different context, is personal relationships mm-hmm. and personal connections. And not just a generation, but generations of young people grew up in Washington, in Sacramento, in Madison, in Austin, in Charlottesville, and any number of other state capitals, thinking that the one of the ways that you developed those relationships was not by giving in to full-on sexual assault, but in the gray area when someone propositions you who might be able to help you professionally, not as a quid pro quo, but because you have a stronger and better relationship. The alcohol, the distance, and the power relationships leads to a situation like we're seeing now. And the one thing I would add on top of that, and Marisa alluded to this earlier as well, gets to the self-protective tendency of any powerful institution. Mm-hmm. When I first got to Sacramento, a long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, the first task I was assigned to work on was reapportionment. redistricting. And it was commonly understood that legislators of both parties drew district lines to protect themselves and each other from competition. And both parties went along with this because it offered a level of mutual protection for both sides. That same instinct towards self-preservation and self-protection that facilitates an easy re-election is the same instinct that leads to the kind of situation that we've been discussing.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. What you're saying reminds me, back in the 90s, there were a number of intern scandals in the U.S. Congress. Mm-hmm. You might remember some of them, Mark Foley and others. A friend of mine at the time was a reporter with the New Republic magazine, which is a Washington-based political journal. And I remember talking to him at the time, and he was just like, you know, this is not surprising. You have these interns here. The interns are away from home. They're young. The congressional female interns wore short skirts, which must have been a dress code made by men. And also to what you were just saying, Dan, and here are a bunch of congressmen who are away from their spouses for a long time. They're living as roommates with other congresspeople.
Which is like a whole issue.
Yeah, it was just kind of like a whole system set up to be a mess.
Yeah, I mean,
asking for trouble.
I've spoken about this on KQED recently. I mean, I've had my own situations when I went up to Sacramento the first time around 2009. You know, you're away from home and you are trying to build these relationships. And so it's not unusual to have a drink with somebody, right? It does get unusual when that person who has children and a wife at home is texting you late at night telling you to come over to basically their frat house with other members and staffers. And I am glad that I had enough sort of poise, as a 20-something-year-old woman to say, you know, that doesn't sound like the best idea, even though I might get a story out of it. Mm-hmm. And then you stop to think. So just to be clear, I told on this member to the speaker's office, which I felt like was the best recourse in that situation because it didn't seem like enough to write a story about, for example. But also, let's think about this. You are a married elected official hitting on somebody with a megaphone. Right. Like, what's happening to the young women who are interns or staffers or lobbyists and don't have the protection that I did when I apparently didn't even have that much protection? So I think that this is obviously something that goes well beyond all of the names that have been said. And when you name that list, I had even missed some because I apparently like went off Twitter for a day or two, you know,
The list is big. And we are certainly talking mostly about men harassing women, certainly lots of men harassing men. And those cases are starting to come out too. And they're saying, you know, they've been emboldened to talk out, speak out finally because of what the women have done with the hashtag Me Too.
And this is obviously a conversation about politics, but it is worth remembering that politics doesn't happen in a vacuum. And politics isn't just a reflection of society. It's an exaggeration of it. And we've talked about a few other sectors. But as someone who's worked in higher education for many, many years, there's a conversation to be had.
Sure.
And it is tempting and in many cases appropriate to vilify the elected officials who abuse their public trust by behaving in this manner. But it is worth remembering that this is a cultural and a social dynamic of which politics is only one small part.
Absolutely.
Yeah, look at UC Berkeley, how many cases they've had.
Yeah.
We've got a lot more to talk about tonight. But
so that was fun.
Before we leave that.
Let's bring everybody down. All politicians are drunk gropers.
Let's
move on.
Yeah.
But we haven't really even talked about Roy Moore. Now, we talked about it at the last program, but what I wanted to get to was something, in fact, someone in the audience raised this as well, which is would all those Republicans who are supporting Roy Moore, and there are lots who are not, but are there all those who are supporting him or not criticizing him, if he was not desperately needed for this GOP tax bill, would they walk away from him, or do you think they're actually
I have some relatives from Alabama, believe it or not, and we don't talk about them a lot, but there are a lot of people in Alabama who say, well, I don't like what he did, and it bothers me, but I'm voting for the Republican, or I'm a Republican, I can't vote for the Democrat. Yeah. And some of them are just not going to vote. They can't bring themselves to vote for Doug Jones, the Democrat, but But they're either going to vote Republican or they're not going to vote. They just can't. I mean, party is that much more important. I was having a conversation with one of them recently, and I said, so you always put party over person. You don't ever look at which is the better person. And, well, but I agree with his policies. What are his policies? And which of them do you think are going to benefit you? And which, you know, people don't want to have that conversation. They don't understand it. They don't want to listen to reason. It depends on the person, of course. But there are a lot of people for whom this is a straight party issue, and they're voting for the Republican.
Well, he has very well thought out. Go ahead, Dan.
Just to offer a contrary viewpoint, and once again, in the interest of self-disclosure, I used to be a Republican, but I am a no party preference voter, and offer this without any partisanship or leanings in one direction or the other. What I find remarkable is how many Republicans in the United States Senate have resisted that impulse.
Mm. Actually, in the Senate, that's
the overwhelming majority of Republicans in the Senate have made it very clear that if this man is elected, they will immediately take steps to remove him from office. Now, I'd like to say that's because of admirable moral principle, and that may be part of it. A lot more of it is because of political self-preservation.
Exactly.
They don't want to have to carry Senator Moore around with them.
Also, they never liked
midterm
him.
Elections.
He
but,
wasn't their guy anyway.
I think you have to give credit. Whether it's Mitch McConnell and Moore, or whether it's Kirsten Gillibrand, when you're willing to call out someone on your own side, that takes a level of courage and bravery that I think is very commendable. And when Donald Trump makes excuses for Moore, and when Nancy Pelosi stumbles around trying to explain why John Conyers wasn't all that bad, after all, I understand that they're facing political imperatives. But for people like McConnell and Gillibrand, I think they are deserving of our admiration, regardless of where you come down politically.
Yeah, and I just got to say that I think both parties need to take a good, hard look in the mirror and think about not one tax bill or even 2020, but what this says about them and this bizarre tribalism that has sort of overcome us, that you would think that just because somebody has a D or an R next to their name that gives more moral weight to whether they've been accused of a sexual crime. I mean, I was really disappointed to hear what Minority Leader Pelosi said on Sunday, and I know that today she came out and said she's spoken to one of the women and she believes her, but to me that's a little too late. And I think it's really, it's something that neither side, they're happy to sort of throw the bombs at the other side and they don't want to deal with. And I don't think either side has the moral high ground on this one.
Okay. Well, on that note, because I'm sure this will never be a news story again, let's just move on. I wanted to talk a bit about Janet Napolitano, the president of the University of California. The East Bay Times and the Mercury News recently editorialized that she should be fired. There have been controversies over a $175 million secret fund, slush fund, whatever you want to call
it. Slush fund's more
slush fund, okay. As well as allegations that two of her top aides had interfered with a state audit. So, just boldly, do you think she should be fired? Or if you don't want to give your personal opinion, do you think that's in the realm of what might happen to
her? In the realm. Let's see, she's been there, what, maybe 5 years now? Do we know how long, how many years has she been there? Anybody know? University presidents are, you're often under a lot of fire, and their tenures are a lot shorter than they used to be. She's had more than her share of controversy. She's sort of toughing it out and doesn't seem like the kind of person inclined to admit wrongdoing or resign. But things can reach a point where that pressure becomes too great. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if at some point she finds some way to conveniently step aside, but I don't see it yet.
What do you think, Dan? Should your boss be fired?
You mean my boss's 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 boss?
She's only his adjunct boss.
There's two separate scandals here, and I think it's important to separate them out. The first is morally reprehensible, the use of taxpayer money not so that young people can attend college without incurring a lifetime of debt, but being used for appallingly lavish purchases. Morally inexcusable, but not illegal. So I think what Napolitano did on that spending spree, unhappily, is not unique to higher education. It's wrong, but it's not illegal, and it leads to some bad unflattering stories, but that's about it. The more recent problem, I think, is a much more serious one. And this is, if not Napolitano herself, her two top advisors intentionally and aggressively suppressing an investigation into the University of California, contacting campus chancellors and high-ranking executives, threatening them and bullying them to withhold information from a state of California investigation. For that, Napolitano does deserve to be fired. And if Lieutenant Governor Newsom becomes Governor Newsom, he's already made it clear that will be one of his first acts, I suspect, as the campaign progresses over the next 11 and a half months. It's pretty clear that whoever replaces Jerry Brown and pays closer attention to these sort of things will want her gone. And then toward Doug's point, her only question is whether she leaves on her own before next November or is pushed out the door by the next governor after next year's election.
I think that would be the timing of it, that, you know, well, I've been here however many years, it's time, but she'll make it look
as good
as possible.
More time with my family.
Yes.
Yeah. Marisa, do you agree her days are numbered?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's just so stupid. Like, why would you do that? Why would you interfere with this? You know, it's never the crime, it's the cover-up, you know? And
it's
it just seems like the... Yeah. I mean, yes, using that money... And I think that this does speak, and I think it goes well beyond Napolitano, but to a sort of culture of entitlement within the UC Office of the President we've seen before and the Regents and this idea that, you know... All of the amazing reporting that's happened over the last 10 years about, you know, administrative salaries and parties and all of these things. And it's just so tone deaf to me that after the drumbeat of years that predated Napolitano's tenure, that they would still be doing this. So, yeah, I don't... I mean, I think it's also a shame because I actually think, you know, like Jerry Brown, she came in and had a lot of experience and some good qualities. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying he did any of this, sorry. But I think, you know, she brought a certain gravitas to that position that I think was needed at the time. And I think it's just sort of a shame that this has been the way it's happened. And, you know, she's not the first person to be in the crosshairs of our state auditor, Elaine Howell. And I think that we often hear cries of politics when Howell does conduct an investigation. And that could be true, but that doesn't mean that her investigation is not true, right? So, yeah. Well,
you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Both the position of chancellor at Berkeley and of president of the UC system, these are like lightning rod jobs. I mean, who was the last person to hold either one of them who wasn't mired in something? And you have to be so, you have to be appreciative of that, mindful of that when you take that
right.
job and really go out of your way, you know, not to light
public money on fire.
Exactly. And I don't understand. I mean, there's a sort of hubris there that you would think in that position that you could get away with anything like that. Or, I mean... If it were me taking that job, I would go out of my way to make sure that didn't happen.
Right.
So it's pretty remarkable.
Well, speaking of tough jobs, I wanted to talk to about our next topic, which is the Republicans in the U.S. Senate are going full bore to try to get their tax bill passed. They're doing whatever they can, all that wheeling and dealing one does, to try to get and just enough votes to get it passed. The House has, of course, already passed a tax cut bill, and the goal is to get President Trump a bill he can sign before the end of this calendar year. So,
I think
Doug,
we should ask Dan, since he's far more knowledgeable than I am. Obviously.
Okay, Dan.
But I have to say, if you'd asked me this, and you probably did a few months ago, whether they would pass a tax reform bill, if we had that, I think we had that conversation, and I said, or I would say, no, it won't pass. They couldn't do Obamacare. They're not going to do tax reform. But then the House did pass something, and the Senate is getting pretty close. And I would not be surprised, actually, and I'd like to hear what you think. I would not be surprised if they do pass this and they hash it out in conference and they do get something to Trump's desk, which would be really his first major legislative achievement.
Yeah. Dan? Yeah,
well, I have not made a correct political prediction since June of 2015 when Donald Trump first announced his campaign for president. So I'm certainly not going to offer a prediction now. I'll offer you this. There's a tremendous incentive for Republicans in both chambers to pass this tax cut, even a lot of them who don't like it, because they don't want to go back to the voters next year with nothing to show for their first 2 years. If they, after 2 years in office, say, we didn't repeal Obamacare, we didn't cut taxes, but by the way, we did extend DACA. That's not the kind of thing that's going to turn out a conservative Republican base in the midterm elections. If you look back at modern political history, a president's first midterm elections, and this by and large is, you know, when we're talking about presidents, we're talking about normal presidents' first midterm elections, their parties tend to lose large amounts of seats. If the Republicans lose the average number of seats that a president's party has lost in a midterm election over the last 40 years, they will lose control of the House of Representatives. So that's just a historical average. And if you're one of those House members, you know that turnout is generally low in midterm elections, which means the election becomes more about base motivation than persuading undecided voters. You see, you know, base Democrats more motivated than they have been probably. I mean, you could make a case for 2006, but you could probably go back to 1974, the last time you saw a Democratic base as motivated as they're likely to be in 2018. And if you're a Republican member of the House of Representatives or the Senate, you think, I've got to go back to my base with something. And even though there's things in this tax cut that I'm not all that excited about, and I know they're not popular with the broader public, I got to give my base something.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, Marisa? Yeah, I agree. And I think you have to look at, like, not what do public opinion polls say generally, but what do they say for the base. But also note that you have, I think, a lot of members sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place, like our four congressional Republicans who voted against this bill, who were people like Daryl Issa, who really like cutting taxes. But when you look at the mortgage deduction, when you look at the fact that, you know, we're not going to be able to write off our taxes, our state and local taxes anymore, I mean, this does not bode well for folks in high tax states like California, New York, New Jersey, et cetera. And then I think, you know, you also have to look at a lot of the details around cuts to welfare programs, cuts to other things that will disproportionately impact the same people who are going to be impacted by an ACA repeal, which is more rural, low-income voters. And so at this point, it does seem like the train is rolling along, but I think every day we're hearing more members of the Senate express at least some concern or you know. So what comes out of conference? What does it look like? Why do we have a Republican Party that doesn't care about deficits anymore? I mean, these are all open questions. But yeah, it does seem like there's this desire to get something done no matter what it looks like. And maybe that'll help them in 2018. But will it help them in 2020?
I mean, that depends on what actually ends up in the bill and how it affects people.
Right. My point, though.
If people don't get the cut they think they're getting, or their taxes go up, or, the actual impact it has on them, it could come back to haunt them.
Well, here's one thing. This is not a prediction, but something to watch over the next 4 days when the Senate votes on this bill. There are some senators who have who've spoken out on matters of public policy. Susan Collins, the last moderate Republican in America, speaking out from one end. Some conservatives speaking out as it relates to the deficit on the other. But here's what to watch. Bob Corker, the senator from Tennessee, and Jeff Flake and John McCain, the two senators from Arizona, all hate Donald Trump. None of them are ever going to seek election again. So even if you are a Republican senator or House member who might not be all that wild about the president, you know that you have to face voters, a certain percentage of whom did support the president. Jeff Flake's not running for re-election. Bob Corker's not running for re-election. It's extremely unlikely that Senator McCain runs for re-election. They are completely empowered, and they are completely free. And as it happens, if the three of them vote no,
that's it.
That is 49 votes for the Republican tax package. So keep an eye on those three.
There's been a lot of talk about the tax cuts that various people and different income levels would get, as well as what corporations would get, and which are permanent and which tax cuts would actually sunset
after.
You're not
going to ask us, like, policy questions.
Yeah, so in line 324 on page 12
of that. Yeah, exactly.
Seven.
But no, actually.
I don't even do my own job.
There's a question from the audience, though, that gets really right to the core of how much maybe Democrats should or shouldn't freak out about this, which is, you know, they can pass this bill calling certain things permanent or certain things that would sunset. Future Congresses could change that, could
sure.
they not?
Sure, a year from now or a year and a half from now, a Democratic Congress could
but it's
that.
Hard to roll back tax cuts. People, even Democrats, don't like to make you pay
take
more money.
Money
they don't, but Bill Clinton came into office and raised taxes. And
yeah, the distinction between a legislation with a 10-year shelf life and a permanent one is not a substantively meaningful distinction. 10 years is a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And forever is longer, but they're both long times.
And we don't know. I mean, I have sat down and tried to figure out whether this tax bill is good for me or not, and I can't. Because part of it is because we don't know for sure what's going to be in it. But like, okay, I lose here, but I gain there, and I'll wait till it's done, and then I'll look at it. So we don't know what impact it's really going to have on a lot of people, and until people see what the actual impact is, the Democrats won't be able to decide if what they want to roll back or not. And,
yeah.
Okay. That's getting ahead of things, I think, a little bit.
Well, let's move on to my favorite fun topic of the night, one of my favorite stories. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau currently has two bosses.
Can't we talk about Prince Harry or something just a little bit more uplifting?
No, I have an idea. I think we should put both of them in like a mud pit.
Well, they could.
They're basically in one now.
Actually, both.
Only
so here's
one
the deal.
Donuts
the head of the CFPB resigned abruptly, and he appointed his deputy to be the acting director until Trump nominates, I guess, a new person or appoints. I don't know if it's...
Technically, he has to nominate and the Senate has to confirm, but he's decided he can appoint an interim.
Right. So this has caused what now is an explicit legal issue where the organization's own lawyer is supporting the Trump administration, but Trump did go ahead and appoint an interim acting director, or I guess an acting director. Both of them showed up for work today. This is according to Politico. White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney, President Trump's choice to temporarily lead the bureau, arrived at about 7:30 a.m. His challenger for the job, CFPB Deputy Director Leandra English, sent the staff an emailed greeting shortly before 8 a.m. and signed it with the bureau's top title, Acting Director. Mulvaney quickly fired back with a memo instructing staff to ignore any instructions from English and invited employees to the bureau's fourth floor for donuts.
My favorite part of that was Mulvaney tweeted out a picture of all these empty Krispy Kreme boxes to
Dunkin'
show.
Dunkin' Donuts.
No, it was Krispy Kreme.
I saw the bag.
The boxes were crispy. I saw some
weird
crispy boxes.
Oh, now he's trying to like
where it
have
gets
it.
Ugly.
Yeah,
this,
this is why people don't trust the news.
It is both.
Yeah,
I'm about to look again.
That's
we'll check. We'll check. Maybe
I'm just
wrong.
Wondering.
Fake news. Yeah.
Look how many donuts they all ate. There's only one left. Clearly, they're all on my side. They all came and ate the donuts. I win.
Because this is what it's come to.
It's a donut war.
Yes.
It's a mess.
It's a mess. Is this just one of those? I mean, it's an interim position anyway. Trump will get the person he wants in there eventually.
It is a bit of a tempest in a teapot because ultimately he'll get to appoint someone and this Senate presumably would confirm them. But in the short term, that bureau, which was created under President Obama after the recession or during still the recession, is responsible for a lot of things and regulations and
protecting consumers.
Right. And has returned something like $12 billion to consumers. But the Republicans have opposed this bureau from the beginning. Elizabeth Warren was supposed to be the first head of it. They wouldn't confirm her, so instead she ran for the Senate. Richard Cordray got the job instead. Now he's going to run for governor of Ohio. But it has an impact. I mean, if the president can put Mulvaney in there for the short term and then eventually get another appointment, that person will serve longer. I mean, it has some impact.
If Mulvaney is the budget director, does he not have enough to fill up?
Well, I heard he said 3 days a week.
Did he say three? Yeah, I thought he said three. Four. Then I was like,
the
math is not.
Run the budget department 3 days a week and run the Consumer Financial 3 days a week.
Sort of begs the question, like,
is
the budget
Sunday?
Director not a full-time job?
Oh, his pension's going to be awesome.
Well, that
is a it's a mess. I have to say, my brother is a consumer law professor, and he has been obsessed with this issue. And he's a bit of an expert on it. And all weekend long, he was texting. I was like, it's Thanksgiving. I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay.
And then I looked at it and went, oh, my God, you're right. This is crazy.
So she already sued the interim.
English, the one who was appointed by the outgoing Cordray, has filed a suit to invalidate the appointment of Mulvaney. and it's going to go to the courts. And the Trump administration counsel who wrote the opinion that the president was right is a former payday lender attorney. So once again, I think...
You can't make this stuff
up. I think the USDA is also now going to require that foxes all report to the hen houses. So, so yeah, it's another classic moment in...
Very good.
Trump world.
Well, so at the end of the president's recent trip to Asia, he reportedly helped get Chinese authorities to release, was it three UCLA basketball players who had been jailed on charges of shoplifting. This not being a normal world, Trump then got into a Twitter feud with the father of one of the players, LeVar Ball, the father. Dan, you actually wrote about this recently. I saw something on it. What do you make? Is either of them correct?
This is a little bit like watching the Iran-Iraq war. I can't decide if there's anybody to root for. both Donald Trump and LeVar Ball are shameless and often obnoxious self-promoters. Both have a sufficient amount of media savvy to know that picking a fight in public and in the news media with someone else of similar levels of bombast plays to their immediate benefit.
I was going to say
a moment ago that this fight over the Consumer Protection Bureau was going to be resolved in a few weeks and we shouldn't be wasting our time on it in the meantime, but because it's now allowed us to talk more about LeVar Ball and Donald Trump fighting about whether Mr. Ball's son was arrested in China or not, can we talk about something else, please? this is the downside of social media. The upside goes back to what we talked about earlier. Everybody gets their own television network. Everybody gets their own media platform. And what that means is the second Anita Hill is somebody we never heard of in 1991. Mm-hmm. Whereas today we hear about number 2, number 3, number 10, number 50, and number 100 because they have the ability to be heard. The flip side of this is everybody gets their own television network. Mm-hmm. Everybody gets their own media platform. And if Donald Trump and LeVar Ball want to fight in a way that no self-respecting reporter would bother have uncovered a quarter of a century ago, mm-hmm. well, we're still talking about it because they have a social media platform that allows them to get more notice on this matter than either one of them deserve.
And it is true that people, you know, some people react by saying, doesn't the president have something better to do than this? But those people aren't going to support him anyway. And the people who say, good, go after that guy, are the ones who are going to support him anyway. So it's sort of playing to the base. It's, I don't know.
Okay. I mean, LeVar, the dad
I find it all exhausting.
Shameless and awful, and now I know that he sells $500 shoes. I had never heard of him before this week, so I guess he wins.
Yeah.
But I do think that there's one thing that is worth noting here on a more substantive claim, which is he's a black man. Mm-hmm. And I do think that there is a racial element of this with Trump's attacks and the way he's gone after him and the basketball players. I don't think it's a coincidence that this is an African-American family that he's picking this fight with and that you know, there
and,
is...
And his tweet, I mean, I felt it was racist. I mean, yeah. it referred to him as, what do you say, a poor man's Don King but with no hair, because LeVar Ball is bald, essentially.
Well, in what Trump...
And you ungrateful fool. And I looked at that, that's like barely even a dog whistle. I mean, that's just, to me, was outright...
And this racist. Is something that... The Trump has learned to the point where it's become simply instinctual for him.
Right.
When he gets into trouble, he picks a fight that will motivate his base. And whether it is National Football League players kneeling for the national anthem, whether it's taking on CNN today, mm-hmm. or whether it's the father of this basketball player, he knows with confidence that even if the majority of the American public does not agree with it does not take his side in the fight that he's picked, his base of support will still be with him either way, but they'll be that much more excited and that much more motivated for him when he takes them on more challenging matters.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's something else that might bother him. His former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, who served for 23 minutes or so in January.
longest serving yet.
Yeah. He apparently has stopped sharing information with the president's lawyers, and this has led people to conclude that that means he's made a deal with the Robert Mueller's FBI investigation. Or I don't know if it's explicitly an FBI investigation, but he's somehow under there. His pension now comes from them. What do you make of this? I mean, do you agree that that probably is what it means? I know you're not a lawyer,
but that could mean what it means, because that is something that happens when people make deals. Attorneys for targets of investigations do share information, mm-hmm. and when one is cutting a deal, they stop. And so people are looking at this saying, aha, this must be a signaling stop. I have been saying, I mean, I've thought for months that Flynn is flipping. When the first indictments came out, I said, it won't be Flynn because he's cooperating, and it wasn't. Now, that doesn't mean I'm right, but my sense of this has been for a while that perhaps mainly to protect his son, who he's very worried about. He doesn't want his son to go to prison. There's so much on Flynn, and he's at least suspected of and seems guilty of so many different things mm-hmm. that they must have a pretty strong case against him, and even he and his attorneys, or probably more likely his attorneys, can see that. So I think it's always been extremely likely that he's the one to cooperate most. That doesn't mean he has something to give them on the president or anyone other than himself, but I do think that, and this is just, to me, just a little more evidence for it, but... Well, you know, time will tell.
John, there's a fascinating biography of Trump that came out right after the election called Trump Revealed by Michael Cranish and Mark Fisher of The Washington Post. And what they postulate when you talk to them, not specifically on this matter but more broadly, is they said if you look at Donald Trump's career over the decades, he's not one generally who digs in for a fight. When he is dealt a losing hand, he folds and he walks away and he claims victory. Mm-hmm. Some of you may remember the Trump shuttle, mm-hmm. His challenges in Atlantic City, Marla Maples. His history is that when he's losing, he walks away and calls it a win. What Fisher and Cranish suppose, and this is before the news of the last couple of days, is that the only thing, in their opinion, or I should say the most likely the thing, in their opinion, that could cause Trump to leave office is if he felt that Mueller, because of Mueller, the walls were closing in. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that that Flynn, like Manafort, is a really, really major cog in this process that Mueller is very, very methodically building. And if Trump believes that Mueller has him dead to rights, he simply says, I have achieved everything I sought out to over the course of my 3.5 years in office, and therefore I will not seek re-election. Whether Mueller knows something that makes Trump impeachable is something none of us can know. But if you look at the way Mueller has built this case, and it's the way prosecutors generally build high-profile cases, is step by step. Mm-hmm. Minnows to small fish to big fish to whales. Mm-hmm. And Mueller and Manafort are pretty good-sized fish.
I agree. Okay. I mean, it does seem like if you know, Papadopoulos and Manafort were sort of the pinnacle of this, then Flynn would have been charged with something already, because right, we do know exactly. So much about right. bizarre dealings and not just around Russia, right? I mean, right. They sort of span the globe. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it does seem likely. But again, yeah, who knows if he has anything on Trump? Who knows if he has anything on anybody? Mm-hmm. But it does seem like next year will not be out before something happens.
But it's unlikely that Mueller would offer him a deal
unless he has something.
Right.
Unless he knows something of extraordinary import.
Right. And no prosecutor, I mean, Mueller or anyone, is going to give you a deal if you have nothing to give them in return. So he's got to have something. But I do think, you know, I can see the scenario where Trump, as you say, declares victory and decides not to run again, or he won't make up a health issue because we know he's the healthiest person who's ever been president. But I also, he's not, I mean, he knows that if you don't win that second term, you're nothing, and that he's not going to want to say he's a loser. And he also won't want to risk losing that re-election bid.
And that's why the Mueller scenario is the one that can take him down that path.
Right.
Because you're right, he wouldn't want to back off without having validated with a second term victory.
Right. But he also won't want to lose.
Unless there were just no other option.
So I think, it'll be interesting to see because he's going to fight that. He's not going to want to not run again. It's going to take a dire scenario for him to say, I've decided not to, for the good of the country, to not seek a second term. I give you Mike Pence.
Someone in the audience asks about a speech that President Trump made today with some Navajo leaders. Uh-huh. If you haven't heard about it, Doug, could you explain what happened?
Sure. So they were honoring the Navajo code talkers. Three of them, I guess, are all that's left. The code talkers were Navajo Nation members who, during World War II, they would use them to communicate between units because the Japanese and the Germans could not decipher Navajo, so they would just speak in their language, and it was a code that couldn't be broken. And I think there are three left surviving, and President Trump was honoring them at a ceremony that was supposed to be honoring this Native American group, and he stood there with them and said, "You were here long before any of us." Well, there's one member of Congress who's been here a long time, too. They call her Pocahontas. So he brought up his Elizabeth Warren slur, that he uses the name of Pocahontas as a slur against, because Elizabeth Warren claims to be 132nd Cherokee, and it's never been proven or disproven, but she has no documentation to back it up. Anyway, so he calls her Pocahontas every time he can. And it was just, everyone was just sort of appalled, like, how, you know, this is supposed to be a somber, he can't get through an event to honor someone without turning it back to himself and slurring someone. It just became another classic moment.
But slurring Elizabeth Warren serves to motivate his base.
Yes, again.
In a week in which a tax cut may or may not pass, it's a way for him to remind his most loyal supporters.
It's true. Although, watching that tape, I doubt he was thinking about, I'm going to motivate my base now. I think he just couldn't resist.
It is. Yeah.
He can't resist. He's Indians, Pocahontas, Elizabeth Warren. He just goes there without even really thinking it through, because that's how it seemed. And
these are just the moments when you like look up at the ticker on CNN on the newsroom and you're just like, what has happened? Like, yeah, that facepalm emoji, like that's just how I feel all day walking by that. Like
But again, the people who are outraged over this and laughing, shaking their heads are people who are going to take that view of pretty much everything he does. And anyone else, you go, so what? Big deal. You know?
Well, and I've got actually a couple of questions here from folks in the audience who are saying, you know, why doesn't the media talk about more substantive stuff? Why aren't you guys talking about, you know, and they list a couple other topics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, why are you talking about tweets? It's like, well, those tweets are pretty much the most substantive things sometimes coming out of the White House. That actually is what the rest of the White House staff then has to follow and mold statements and policies around, because those are what he really thinks.
He's a Twitter president. I mean, those are his pronouncements.
Yeah.
Well, let's separate out the mechanism of communicating with an audience in 140 characters from the content of that communications. Mm-hmm. If President Hillary Clinton or President Jeb Bush were sending out lots of tweets, we probably wouldn't be wringing our hands about it all that much.
They wouldn't be writing them.
They'd be boring.
Well, you don't know that because Bill Clinton was the cable TV president. Ronald Reagan was the television president. Franklin Roosevelt was the radio president. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there were naysayers at every step along the way saying how undignified, how inappropriate. And the people who said that were probably the political opponents of each of the people, of each of the presidents leading that breakthrough. I'm sure when the first town leader used the Gutenberg press in order to print flyers to hand out. They said, how undignified for a leader in our
community. Yeah, I mean, my problem isn't Twitter. But it's the substance.
It's what he says on Twitter.
Precisely.
In fact. I think we had a couple tweets.
Which he would say anyway. It's just a way for him to do it off the cuff in a very flip way and reach a lot of people at once.
But where we started this little vignette was, why are you talking about tweets?
Right.
And you could have said in a previous era, why are you talking about fireside chats? Mm-hmm. Why are you talking about televised debates? Mm-hmm. Because that's what the technology allows in terms of communications platforms. The content, I think, is where we all...
Right.
He governs by tweet. I mean, this isn't us making hay of something that has no bearing on reality. I mean, often, as you said, he will tweet something that will actually contradict what his own administration said minutes before. And who are you going to believe? I mean, the president of the United States of America or a spokesperson at an agency, right? So it's frustrating. I tried turning off my tweet notifications from Donald Trump. And then I kept missing stories that I needed to cover. So now I just, like, take a deep breath in the morning, roll over, look at my phone, think, what am I going to deal with today? You know, but it's true, and it is weird. We had Tamara Keith from NPR at KQED last week, and I was asking her, because, I mean, that's her whole job, is covering the president. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think, very difficult and sometimes frustrating because, again, every previous administration, party, doesn't matter, had very, in most cases, but their message was
message
thought
discipline.
Out. And it was discipline. I mean, we don't even need to get into, like, can you imagine how Obama would be attacked if he said, like, one-tenth or even said anything without the thought that that Trump gives to it? But that's sort of just, like, politics 101. I mean, you know, look at Sacramento. It's not as if these statements haven't been vetted by 45 people before they put out some meaningless, you know, two-sentence remark on a hearing that happened yesterday. And
which,
Trump,
of course, if you bring this back full circle, is part of the key to the appeal of both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders when they ran for president last year, because they were, in the eyes of many of their supporters, genuine and authentic voices. As opposed,
they tell it like it is. They're unvarnished. They're not calculated. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, on that note, we're going to move to our news quiz. I'm going to ask some news quiz questions. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll call on you. You shout out the answer. If you get it correct, Fran will give you some chocolate. Okay. So the first question: on Saturday, former President George Herbert Walker Bush broke what record? Sir, your hand went up first. The oldest living president, that is correct. He's at 93 years and 166 days as of Saturday. He broke the record previously held by Gerald Ford. Okay.
He broke Herbert Hoover's record.
Did he? Do you know what organization in San Francisco Herbert Hoover was a longtime member of?
The Commonwealth Club.
Very good.
Do I get some chocolate?
Yeah,
no, you don't. You had a glass of wine. That's what we pay our speakers here. Israel's health minister resigned from Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet in protest over what? Ma'am, your hand went right up. That's right. Working on Saturdays to fix the trains. They tended to do it over the Sabbath because they weren't being used. Okay, next question. A $10 million payoff was reportedly part of the deal to get whom to resign, or who to resign, actually. Ma'am. Robert Mugabe, that's correct. Longtime president of Zimbabwe. Let's see, fourth question. A future trade deal between the United Kingdom and the European Union could be vetoed by Ireland's government if what issue is not resolved? What's their key issue? Ma'am, way back there. That is correct. If Northern Ireland is no longer in the EU, but Ireland is, that could become a hard border, which would mean, obviously, customs and everything else. Ireland does not want that to happen. Britain doesn't seem to really have control over its own negotiations at the moment. So, what holiday activity from the old WKRP in Cincinnati TV series actually takes place in Arkansas every Thanksgiving? You must have seen this episode.
John, can I?
Dan, I will give you chocolate if you get this correct.
The turkey drop.
That is right. They drop live turkeys from a plane. If you have not seen this episode, go to Google and Google
YouTube.
WKRP, or your YouTube directly, because you're going to get there eventually. WKRP Thanksgiving or Turkey Drop. It's one of the best sitcom episodes of any series at all.
Noted.
Yes, as God is my witness, I thought turkeys could fly. That will make sense when you watch it. Okay. Islamic State is blamed for a mosque attack that killed more than 300 people in what country? Sir, you are fast.
Egypt,
that is correct. Number are we at? It's number six. Okay. A man canceled his plans to shoot himself into the air in a homemade steam-powered rocket in an effort to prove what theory? Sir, right along the ball there. He's a believer in the flat earth theory. Now we'll never know.
He's from my husband's hometown, something I am not going to let him forget, Apple Valley.
Okay. Actress Shirley Jones paid tribute this weekend to her stepson, who passed away. Who was he? Way back there in the lavender?
David Cassidy.
David Cassidy, her stepson. That is correct. Whose net worth just cleared $100 billion? Way in back, ma'am. Sorry? Yes, Amazon's Jeff Bezos. Okay, two more. He's been dead for 170 years, but scientists have concluded that tuberculosis was the cause of death of what famous composer? Ma'am. Chopin, that's correct. Last one. Am I correct? We've got one more after this. Very good. Last time we did the show, I got flack for not having happy questions, so...
We didn't include that Egyptian ISIS attack.
What, according to dictionary.com, is the 2017 word of the year? Ma'am, second row. Complicit. That is correct. The word is complicit. Well, we will have more news quiz questions and lots more to talk about. On Monday, December 11th, that's going to be with our holiday social, so you'll definitely not want to miss it. Thank you, Doug Sovereign, Marisa Lagos, Dan Schnur, and all of you here today. Everyone listening online and watching. Have a great week.